podcasters. This is Brooke with Let's Talk Art. Today I'm talking art with Stefano Catalani of the Bellevue Arts Museum in Washington. We're talking about their Strategies for Survival exhibition by the artist Bren Ahern, which goes on until January 15th, 2017. We're still in the process of lining up sponsors for Let's Talk Art with Brooke, but in the meantime, if you'd like to support the podcast, please look for my book, Reptiles on Caffeine, on Amazon. Enjoy the podcast. So tell me about this exhibition, the Strategies for Survival.
Yes. I came across Bren Ahern's work the first time maybe 6 or 7 years ago. Mm-hmm. There was a conference in San Francisco State University called Reinvention. It was a textile fiber art conference, and I believe I saw one of his samplers. Later, Marcy Rainick-Dade, who is the editor of Surface Design magazine, she asked me to write an essay on three artists that would somehow share this idea of not being compliant with rules of conduct and gender specific roles, and therefore I wrote this essay, and one of the three artists was Bren. So from that essay actually came the idea to celebrate his work here at the Bellevue Arts Museum with a solo exhibition. This is his first solo exhibition, museum exhibition.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Well, I was so excited to read about this exhibition because I grew up, my mother did cross stitch, which is different than what he does, but she did a lot of samplers. So I grew up with samplers all around me, and I was just so tickled with this exhibition. So he made like samplers for men, basically.
Well, he basically definitely the point of departure is the sampler is traditional cloth that was used, especially in the 1800s, for the education of middle upper class girls. It was part of the education to the alphabet, the numbers, but also mostly embroidery and cross stitching. But not just cross stitching. There is actually, as you might know, samplers actually are samplers, as the word says, of many different stitches. And so, originally, though, earlier in 1600 and 1700, the sampler served the purpose of somehow sampling, working as an example of different stitches. And also, it was sort of a portable cheat sheet, if you will, where the letters, the alphabet, and the numbers would be copied in different stitches. So if the maid in a house had to fix, mend, a shirt or a pillowcase and had re-embroidered the initials of the owners of the then she could basically pull out of her apron this sampler, and she could basically imitate or copy. But usually, these samplers, as you may know, they come in two forms: spot samplers, band samplers. But they all have a sort of a moral, religious sentence or teaching. Sometimes they can be very morbid, especially because they address mortality.
Right.
Which, in the reality of the 1700s and 1600s, where a woman could die, a child could die of influenza or other terrible diseases,
right,
or could die of childbirth. So when the span of life was not really the expectation, life expectation was very high, this morbidity actually made sense. But Bren basically taps into this incredible narrative device and then takes the sampler to transform it into a kind of each sampler into a very personal page of a diary where he chronicles, if you will, the moments in which he felt that he was not compliant with the gender expectations and also with the awkwardness, if you will, of growing up. When you do not believe, you do not feel that you belong to the bunch, you're
right,
sort of excluded or, yeah. So they're very touching and very emotionally charged, but also have sometimes a very droll sense of humor, if you will.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And so, yes.
Oh, go ahead.
We made a small selection, about 12 samplers. This is not the only body of work that, fiber that the artist has produced or produces, but this was the one that was more interesting to me. I wanted to use his work to move from the personal to the universal. I believe whether or not what I'm trying to say, sorry, is that gender expectations are very pressing within society, both of boys, and
right.
especially for men, there is this very strong expectations of masculinity being treated as physical vigor and strength, aggressiveness, testosterone, a certain bullying behavior, and for those who do not fit into this model, there are moments which are not pleasant. Independently whether this person is not complying with gender role-specific expectations because it belongs to a minority LGBTQ group or not. So although the artist definitely belongs to, is a queer artist, if you will, mm-hmm. At the same time, the exhibition here at the Belgrade Arts Museum puts this in the back burner and actually addresses this idea of awkwardness in a very much more general, universal way,
right.
So that anybody can read this sentence, can find him or herself.
Right, because everyone feels awkwardness.
Yes, every girl must have put wrong socks at some point in her life, and
exactly.
Her girlfriends might have laughed, or anybody might have made the wrong choice of accessory.
Right.
And so,
absolutely.
So the show wants to celebrate the center as a narrative device. Fiber as a medium that has a strong existential connection and connotation, I should have said. And then, and also the artist has a brilliant person who is able to transform the personal into universal, and there, I think there is a gem there.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. And I was looking at some of his samplers, and they're so funny. There's one that says, "When Daddy dresses me my blue uniform, I become a man," and it's in this like just this conservative, just kind of like this I guess the normal sampler model. And it's just so funny. It's just so, just kind of out of place. It's just very humorous, I think.
And it's humorous. It's also one of the earliest the artist created, and also I think it's sampler number 2 actually. It's cross stitched in blue floss.
Right.
Definitely for me, the reason why I selected this piece was that. Brings together two important elements about gender expectations, especially when it comes to masculinity or manhood, which is basically the idea of blue is for boy, and that's something that, it's sort of this first cultural imprinting that you receive. Pink is for girls and blue is for boys. But in this
right.
case, also the idea of the uniform.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that the U.S. Army, for example, says that the blue is, the blue uniform is the broad line. So the idea is blue uniform as a symbol of masculinity, as a symbol of. I felt that this piece speaks volume of the imprinting of printing that you are a man only when you wear a uniform. And if you notice, the sampler is actually dated. Brian Ahern is signed. Brian Ahern aged one day, so it's almost like this fictional moment where a one-day-old boy could actually cross-stitch a sampler and basically saying, "My future is already on the track becoming a man only when I'm dressed in a blue uniform."
Oh, that's cool. That's cool. Yeah, like
it also has a little. If you will, a double entendre, a little bit, it's not really a double entendre, it's a little bit of a, some sort of sexual connotations, the idea of daddy used in in the sentence and uniform. Might refer to certain homoerotic scenes that you might imagine of wearing the uniforms and then calling the dominant figure pop or a daddy. And so in this case, I feel that there is also this interesting connotation to this piece.
Yeah, that's funny. and then you have, there's also one that says, I guess the flowered lunchbox was the wrong accessory.
Yeah, that's actually a temper that is very large, it's much larger. It actually is not an actual size of a semper. I believe it's, the height is at least 85 or 86 inches, so it's a large semper. The artist remembers his first day of school and going to school with a lunchbox that had flower pattern. And although his parents were very liberal and let him choose whatever pattern for the lunchbox he liked.
Right.
However, once he went to school, went to class, which is sort of our first impact with society at large, if you will,
right.
He was immediately laughed at by the other boys. And so, so there is this sort of magnifying moment where, he realizes that he's done something wrong, mm-hmm. according to society. And
right.
So, in a way, the large scale of the center of the work of art here sort of also magnifies this awkwardness of realizing that, oh, I might have made the wrong choice.
Right, and everyone knows that, too. That's a universal concept as well. Everyone's experienced that.
Yes, and if you look at the pattern of the flower lunchbox in this way, in this case, is actually created with baseballs and footballs, and so there is also this sort of ebb and flow between a flowery feminine pattern and then sort of this sense of sporty masculine symbol, which is the playing field and the baseball and the football.
Right. So how did he get involved in needlepoint?
I believe that he comes from a family that's always fostered creativity and involvement with crafts.
Mm-hmm.
And I think both his mother and his grandmother have embroidered and worked in fiber. I believe that he actually enrolled in the textile. He was mostly become a weaver, I believe. But I believe also that his attention was immediately captured by the immediacy that embroidery can provide to the execution. Meaning weaving might be very lengthy and very long, very lengthy process, and embroidery allowed him instead, I think, a much more fast turnaround, and also the ability to use fiber with a very strong narrative connotation rather than just weaving that would be just creating fabrics. And so I feel that, if I remember correctly now, I feel that he enrolled at university, wanted to go to clay, but the classes in ceramics were full.
Mm-hmm.
So he enrolled in textiles, and then ultimately he decided to choose embroidery as his medium because it favors sort of narrative component and more immediate results versus the weaving that can be much more
tedious.
Tedious, correct. Tedious and lengthy, yes.
Yeah. So I think that's so cool because did I understand you to say that he had kind of experience in weaving or needlepoint before he went to school?
I think I don't know if he had a direct experience. This would be a question that would actually be good to ask to him. But definitely he had grown in an environment where
he was familiar with it.
Embroidery, yes, and class activities, especially when it came to crochet or embroidery or knitting, where part of the activity around the house. After all, I think He's also, I think, in his late 40s or early 50s. So in the 70s growing up, late 60s, early 70s growing up, there was definitely a craft revival. And so there was a lot of macrame and knitting and crocheting and embroidery. And so he was surrounded by this family. I think he felt that there was a vocabulary or language, I should say, that he was very comfortable with when he went to back to school. Mm-hmm. I think, which is, yeah.
Cool. Yeah, I think that's so funny that just, you know, stuff that people were laughing at him about, he's making all kinds of money doing. And I think that's cool.
Yeah, I don't know if it's, I mean, definitely Bren is dedicated to his craft and to his art, and we're very excited to have him here at the Belgrade Arts Museum with his solo exhibition. The title, I should have mentioned, Strategies for Survival, mm-hmm. Couldn't be more timely, unfortunately. And the reason is that one of the samplers, or I would say a modern interpretation of a sampler, is actually a large hood panel, all cross-stitched, or actually partially cross-stitched and partially used with other stitches. But basically, it is the replica, it's a perfect replica of filled up of a little card, the size of almost a business card that he received at UC Davis with instructions instructions or strategies for survival, mm-hmm. in case of a shooter on campus. And so he was very touched by this little card that is distributed to all the professors and all the students, and that somehow breaks down the actions that you are supposed to follow in order to save your life in case of an active shooter on campus. So he decided to create a sampler out of this card. Mm-hmm. It's actually almost a very faithful replica, just scaled up to probably 48 inches by probably 25 or 30 inches. And it is a sampler because it addresses mortality, addresses ephemerality, addresses this idea that your life could end any moment. So mm-hmm. it sends a message that is as morbid as the message that was in the traditional 1700s, 1800s English or early Republican and colonial times in America, samplers. Mm-hmm. So the Strategies for Survival was lifted from this card and this sampler, and then became the title of the exhibition.
Cool. Yeah, I think that's so great because, I mean, it is very timely. I didn't get that at first. I just thought that I thought it was just strategies for survival and growing up, because you certainly need those.
It stretches. We wanted to the decision to include this sampler along with other two samplers that also address the situation of an active shooter on campus, and this was done before the dramatic attacks of Orlando, but definitely, you know, Orlando is not the first time when we have shooting. Yeah. The decision curatorially to include these three samplers was to again to stretch and to stretch from the personal, so the samplers that would be addressing his personal emotions of awkwardness growing up, to the universal or to the societal or to the political. So mm-hmm. those moments of awkwardness when you receive a card that tells you how you are supposed to, what are their strategies for survival in case of an active shooter on campus. And so, again, that was a very personal moment, but by embroidering it, he makes it a political statement. Mm-hmm. And so in this translation from the paper that is printed to the canvas that is embroidered, he transforms a very personal, awkward moment into a political statement. And so the reason why also they were included is that they're still somehow pages of his diary, and they're still about a moment of awkwardness, but in this case they're very, they're not just about Brenna Hearn, they're about everybody else that in the room received the same card. And today, everybody of us who basically, when is, you know, in a public setting, has to worry about whether or not it's ready in case of a situation with an active shooter.
Right, right. Yeah, and sadly, that's all too relevant to these days.
Yes.
So this was timely. Now, Is this his, what other exhibitions has he been featured in? Because Needlepoint is not, I don't know, I've never heard of a Needlepoint exhibition in a gallery or a museum. I mean, are they common?
Well, I don't know. I mean, Brian has been included in many group shows on the West Coast and in other parts of the United States of America, mostly group shows that address whether the narrative power of fiber art or, in this case, the message that he's conveying, especially exhibitions that maybe might focus on a queer perspective. But the museum that focuses on art, craft, and design, and definitely fiber as a medium, is a hot medium today, as much as ceramics, as much as clay, and is a medium that somehow, because of its closeness to the human body, we all wear garments, we all use fabric to clothe ourselves, so it's very much associated with our own public persona, but also our intimate personal sphere,
yes.
And therefore has, and also, so it can project an image of, you know, wealth, or an image of protection, or an image of, or it can be something very, very intimate, like Linus Blank. So what I'm saying is, fiber offers a vast range of entry points to address political, personal, existential aspects of our lives, whether individual or societal, and therefore it's a perfect material,
it's a perfect medium.
Medium, yes, for artistic production. And craft definitely is no longer just the execution of something that is steeped in tradition but empty or divorced from meaning, but craft has become a social practice that addresses very deep, very important social issues. So we have had many exhibitions of the Belgrade Museum that, you know, put on the pedestal, so to speak, fiber as medium and addressing all the narratives and the potential for this medium to address the human condition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's great, and I just think it's he's like a pioneer. I love his work, and I'd never heard of Needlepoint exhibitions before, but they're perfect.
Well, no, I think there have been many exhibitions over the years. Definitely the first one that, there are many artists that use, Needlepoint or crochet or...
Right.
Meeting, but definitely is the first one that uses the narrative device of the sampler and its power to convey a message.
Right. I was talking about this podcast interview to someone, and I was trying to explain what a sampler was, and my boyfriend came up with a good explanation. He was like, it's like an iPad for the 18th century. And I was like, oh, that's just really cool. That's correct.
Anyway, it is an iPad for the 18th century. It is also, it's something that you, if you think about it, it's basically a piece of cloth, not bigger than maybe, one foot by 8 inches, and you can easily roll and put in your apron, in your pocket, and carry around.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a way to... it's an educational, pedagogic tool. You can teach both writing, letters and numbers, but also you can teach stitching and embroidery.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is also a tool for discipline. I don't know if I would consider an iPad, because you will not be able to do. You can keep staring, and it's definitely something that you can do.
Right.
But it is activated only when you use it, and maybe it is not a bad comparison.
Yeah, I thought that was I never heard. I was just surprised and just kind of delighted, because I never really thought of it that way. even though I was familiar with samplers and what they had done. But yeah, I think this is so unique. So how did you get connected with Bren?
Oh, we knew each other when I interviewed him for the article that appeared on Surface Design Magazine, as I mentioned.
Oh, that's right.
Interview. We became friends, and then I've done several trips down to San Francisco to meet him and see his work. And rather than just seeing his work through JPEGs or images, that we would exchange. And so it's been a natural cultivation and of both a personal relationship and friendship, and then ultimately the show that opened about 2 weeks ago is sort of the culmination of all this work.
Cool. What's the response been?
Pardon?
What has the response been from other people, like the people who come?
The show has been very received. Mm-hmm. I mean, for a show that occupies only one of the galleries of our museum, we do have sometimes 3 to 4 shows at a time, mm-hmm. And we can now dedicate the same resources in terms of marketing and promotion to all the exhibitions. For an exhibition that occupying the Dworfine Family Gallery, one of the smallest exhibition spaces, is about maybe 1,000 square feet. We have received a lot of attention, not only here, visitors, of course, who love the work, but also there have been some other press locally, and actually we were on Art Daily nationally last week. So we
right, yeah, that's right. That's right. I read about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cool. That's awesome.
Well, thank you so much for allowing me to speak on this work, and it was a pleasure to be interviewed and talk to you and this blog.
Thank you so much to Stefano Catalani of the Bellevue Arts Museum for telling us about the Strategies for Survival exhibition. And thank you to you for listening. I know I learned a lot. If you're in the Bellevue area, check out the museum. If you're interested in having us promote your product or service, you have a comment, you have ideas for future podcasts, or would like to be on the show yourself, please contact me at arttalkwithbrooke@gmail.com.
Let's Talk Art with Brooke is a Hotspur Enterprises media production.